good evening. Thank you all very much indeed for coming this evening. I'm Carol Stone. I'm president of the Media Society, and this is the first time we've had a joint event, I'm pleased to say, with media at LSE. And a great thanks to Roger Silverstone, the Professor of Media and Communications here at LSE, who's helped not only get the panel together, make sure it works this evening, and provide this lovely venue. So, the topic tonight, as you know, is being debated by the Davis Committee, set up by the Secretary of State Department Culture Committee, Paul Smith, and due to report very soon. And also other things that the BBC are in the news at the moment, not least of all reports to the next Director General. But we're not here to talk about that tonight. Tonight, the format is a brief, up to 5 minutes maximum from each panel member, who will state their case, as it were, followed by questions from the floor. And we hope we'll have lots of questions, because we want to give you plenty of time for them. And we aim to end by 8 o'clock, and if later, not more than a few minutes later. So, to chair the event and to introduce the panel to you is Richard Lindley, who's television journalist, Richard Lindley, BBC, ITN, ITV, ITN World News, the satellite channel, also being a broadcasting regulator, ensuring fairness and impartiality in news and foreign affairs programmes. So I'm sure it's going to ensure the same this evening. A welcome to our panel, and over to Richard Lindley.
Well, no doubt at enormous expense, the consultants McKinsey have recently carried out more research for the BBC around the world. They found, they say, that where a public service broadcaster got its money from a licence fee, like the BBC in the UK, then programmes were at their best. And they went on to show that where there was such a licence-funded public service broadcaster, then commercial broadcasters in the same country were better too. It's a wonderful endorsement of a licence fee system that's funded the BBC since it began in the early 1920s. But how long can what is in effect a poll tax on us all be sustained when hundreds of digital channels are beginning to nibble away at the BBC's mainstream audience? Will the licence now have to be replaced? And if so, with what? Well, that's the question our distinguished panel has agreed to address tonight. In alphabetical order, they are David Elstein, the BBC's youngest ever graduate trainee. He's run his own independent production company.
I can't.
It's not Heather. He was director of programmes at Thames Television. At B Sky B, he was head of programming, and he's currently chief executive of Channel 5 Broadcasting, and he could be the next director general of the BBC. Ray Gallagher.
My lips are sealed.
Ray Gallagher on the end here is Director of Public Affairs at B Sky B, where he's been ever since the sensational startup and extraordinary progress of a company that's led the way towards the digital future. Like all the commercial broadcasters, he argues that the BBC is using licence fee money to compete unfairly in the media market. Andrew Graham on the end here is acting master of Balliol College, Oxford. He's also the co-author, with Gavin Davies, who's now inquiring into the issue of broadcasting society and policy in the multimedia age. Public service broadcasting, he says, is not just a product, but the company we keep, worth paying for through an increased licence fee. The Right Honourable General Kaufman, MP, has been tangling with the broadcasters since he was press secretary to Prime Minister Harold Wilson. He's now the widely respected, which probably means widely feared, chairman of the Select Committee for Culture, Media and Sport. He's speaking tonight in his personal capacity. His present recommendation for funding the BBC, privatise it. And finally, on my left, Heather Abatz. As chief executive of Lambeth Council, she knows all about raising the money to run services that people want, but may be unwilling to pay enough for. Briefly a member of the Davis Committee, she resigned to become a BBC governor. Ladies and gentlemen, your panel. So, if we are now in sight of losing the licence, how will we fund the future of broadcasting? General Kaufman.
The news today, both on the front pages and on the city pages, is of the later stage in competition for the digital audience between On Digital and B Sky B. We do not hear of anything that the BBC is doing to attract a digital audience. The one thing we do know about the BBC is that they want to increase that regressive poll tax which finances them at present. Let's look at this organisation. Although publicly owned, it is the only broadcasting organisation in this country which is unaccountable to the public which finances it. It is far less enterprising than any of the other broadcasting organisations, with the exception of the Channel 3 companies, and that's very faint praise indeed. It provides far fewer services than any of its major competitors. It misuses a great deal of the money that it gets. For example, the £30 million that it spends on BBC News 24, which hardly anybody watches, but which is provided free to cable to compete with B-Sky B's subscription services. And yet it sits back and asks for more money through a regressive poll tax. 20 years ago, it might have been acceptable. Today we live in a completely different environment. The BBC itself is now in the commercial market with commercial activities, I won't dignify them by the word enterprises, so it is a hybrid organisation, not a pure publicly owned corporation. It's doing its job less and well. If you want to look at the BBC standards, look at the Big Ticket show which it had to abandon and the Vanessa show which it has not abandoned. It behaves as though we were in the year 1950, yet we are in fact almost in the year 2000. There is a new environment in broadcasting, and although, as I said, we read about the latest stages of competition for the digital audience in the press this morning, even the digital competition is in many ways a brawl in a side alley. Mark Booth has left B-Sky B to run a company which deals with internet services. That's where the future is. The big news today in the press is not on digital's latest offer. It is the fact that PhotoMe is going to convert its photographic booths all over the country for internet services. That is the way of the future. We shall soon have a converged box. It's coming, it's very near. The BBC should be getting into that market, which is the market of the future, instead of demanding extra money for stopgap digital services. The only way in which public service standards, which have been established by the BBC and which are the BBC's glory and will be its legacy, is privatisation to force the BBC to compete with these other forces in the market rather than sit back and saying it isn't fair and they want more money.
Thank you very much indeed.
Go home now.
Save your power.
I think I will.
Andrew Graham, you feel if the BBC didn't exist, we need to invent something very like it. Your turn now.
The fundamental question about funding BBC is, I have to ask, why do you want it in the first place? If you can think of good reasons for why you need it, then those reasons might suggest how you'd want to fund it. So let's address the really fundamental question. Let's not ask whether the BBC, as it's currently been operating in the last year or so, has been doing a good job or a bad job. That's the not the big long-term question. The big long-term question is, do we need this institution? So I want to begin by offering you four reasons why we need it. They're all fairly obvious. One, in a democratic society, you need a broadcaster which is both independent of government and independent of the market. Think of it by analogy. I wouldn't particularly, with children, want them to go to schools that were directly run by the Home Secretary. They nearly are these days, that's a bad mistake. And I wouldn't want them to go to schools that were run by McDonald's or Coca-Cola. People have to make up their own minds, and in a democratic society, it's just absolutely fundamental that one of your broadcasters is independent of these two bodies. We in the UK have almost unique now in the world, you can't be almost unique, but we're very much on our own in having a broadcaster which managed to occupy this position, somewhat independent of state and independent of the market. The second reason is that people have rights. Rights which come from being citizens of their society. And those rights mean that they have the right to achieve certain information about their society. More and more, that information will come through the television set. So it has to come from a source which is a trusted source. Not always getting it right, but often getting it right and free. In exactly the same way as healthcare ought to be free, information of certain kinds ought to be free. Democratic, one. Rights, two. A third reason, a little bit more problematic to see at the beginning, there's what I call common knowledge. This is, in economics, a technical term. It means what everybody knows that everybody else knows. It's actually incredibly important to the functioning of society. Let me give you some examples of what might be regarded as common disknowledge. If you look at Microsoft's Encarta and search for Civil War, you only find one Civil War, the American Civil War. There have been a few others in history. If you search on Microsoft's Encarta for Christian Democracy, the largest political party in Europe, it doesn't exist. This is information that's being put out by a computer company because its prime purpose is to make money out of selling on Microsoft's Encarta. It doesn't have as its prime purpose making sure that its information is relevant to the culture in which it's embedded and that it's accurate. Another example, Diane Abbott went into a school in South London and asked the school kids what was the emergency telephone number. 9 out of 10 kids replied 911. That's the American emergency telephone number. Common knowledge in this society is knowing what you need to function in this society. And in a world that's going more and more global, you still need information that's quite familiar and works where you are, not somewhere else. That, I think, is a very important part of a public service broadcaster. The last reason is that everybody's talking about the new technological revolution and saying there are going to be hundreds of channels, there's going to be loads of competition. It's this new competitive world. Why doesn't the BBC wake up and become competitive? The point is that the very same technology that's producing more and more channels is going to produce more monopolies. With digital, it costs you literally zero to make a second copy of something. Huge gap between the first copy and the second copy. What economists call massive economies of scale. Strong pressures towards big firms. What's more, everybody talks about convergence. Publishers, printing firms, getting like television firms, which are getting like other bits of the media, all coming together. If there's lots of convergence, that's what economists call economies of scope. You want to be owning lots and lots of outlets in order to be able to incur some costs, first of all, getting a story, and then put it out everywhere. Economies of scope plus economies of scale will mean you've got lots of channels, but few owners, monopoly. So you need the BBC more now, not less, as an antidote to monopoly.
Andrew, I've got to draw you towards a close. Could you just say, though, how shall we fund it?
Keep the license fee going, but it needs to grow faster than inflation because the BBC's costs are primarily labour costs and scarce costs. If you can't do that, think of something else. Nothing's perfect, not even the license fee is perfect. A tax on digital TV, in exactly the same way as we moved from black and white to colour television, we paid more then. Pay more as you move from analog to digital.
Thank you very much indeed. Ray Gallagher.
Thank you. I would certainly agree with Andrew on one point. The starting point is, do we need this institution? In order to evaluate whether the license fee needs to be maintained or supplemented, it's important first to be clear about what the government and the public would like the BBC to do. Now, Sky believes that the license fee should be limited to funding and ensuring the universal availability of material which would find no home in the commercial market, but which is deemed to be an essential public good. And we don't believe that the BBC needs a supplement to the license fee from any revenue stream that's already not at its disposal to accomplish this. At the end of 1996, the BBC went before Parliament, from Gerald's committee, and presented its digital strategy. And it said, we'll fund the lion's share of the investment necessary from the increased efficiency of the BBC and from the contribution of our commercial arm. But it said that the scale of investment necessary to make the transition to digital required just a very modest increase in the license fee. And this was, again, not just for digital, but for enhancement of core services that they said this. This, they said, would ensure that the UK makes a successful transition to the digital era. The BBC requested and subsequently received government support and substantial public funding for that purpose. The license fee was increased by terms that were the first real increase in more than a decade to give extra income to go digital. And in addition to that, the government earmarked £244 million from the sell-off of the transmission network for the BBC's digital plans. Since then, there's been substantial contributions that have been made from efficiency savings. £76 million just in the last financial year that was reported. The next financial year report is coming up next month. And over the last 3 years that were reported, £281 million in efficiency savings. On the commercial side, BBC Worldwide has said it's going to quadruple the cash it returns to the BBC by 2006. A figure which Gerald's Select Committee actually described as markedly unambitious given the demand for material and the scope for new services. These revenues, I perhaps will heretically say, could ultimately allow the BBC to reduce the license fee to the benefit of all of its viewers. So there should be ample scope in the BBC's current operational and financial framework for all of these activities. Furthermore, the BBC does not need to and should not be using public funds for certain activities like BBC News 24. Tens of millions of pounds could be used for core services and other universal public service goods. The BBC's use of these funds doesn't even comply with its own set of commitments to using public money. In 1996, it set out its 10-year vision for digital called Extending Choice in the Digital Age. And it said at that time that it would put license fee-funded services first and ensure that license fee payers get maximum value from their investment. It said it would increase the quality of the existing services on radio and television, and when launching new services to pay a so-called digital dividend, it would apply certain clear criteria. The services to be launched were to be, first, to be of a range or quality not guaranteed in the commercial market. Secondly, accessible to all immediately or within a reasonable period of time. Thirdly, of such appeal to audiences as to justify public funding. And lastly, affordable to the BBC against other priorities. News 24 fails the BBC's own test on all four of these counts. It was launched into a commercial market, already providing 24-hour news channels of considerable range and quality. And research shows in Sky News and other services the level of viewership is extremely small. Sky News has about five times as much viewership as BBC News 24. Secondly, it will not be available to the public universally within any reasonable period of time. The BBC itself noted that even the best estimates, well, I should say most estimates, the consensus estimates, were that only half the homes in the UK would go digital by 2005. With such limited audiences, it's impossible to demonstrate an appeal to audiences to justify public funding. Andrew referred to the need for common knowledge. A service that provides literally 0.1% of all nationwide viewing, as the research figures confirmed from the ITC, doesn't justify public funding. And lastly, its affordability against other priorities has been questioned by many, not least within the BBC itself. Now, the last thing I'd like to say is just on the digital license fee. The proposed tax to fund new services from the digital fee should be rejected because this would distort competition and damage the prospects of digital take-up in the UK. It's important, again, to note the BBC's own views on this issue. It told Parliament that it was against the idea of a higher digital license fee, believing that everyone should pay for its service. John Burt specifically told MPs that a higher license fee, quote, for receiving digital programs would in effect be a tax on innovation. This idea of a digital supplement or tax on digital homes is a very poor attempt at a user pays principle. And homes that have chosen digital TV have not necessarily made any positive decision that they're choosing BBC services in contrast to past services when colour TV and general TV was launched. If a user pays principle is to be adopted for the first time in public service television, breaking decades of bundling of all public service broadcasting together under one fee, then the solution is to follow it to its logical conclusion, which is subscription for each of these individual services in digital homes because the technology exists. to allow each individual digital home either to opt in or opt out of any particular service.
Ray, thank you very much. Can I just, on a point of clarification, you seem to be saying that you're happy with the license fee as long as it funds programs that the market won't provide. So only the most boring and tedious is, how could you just explain that very briefly?
It's not a matter for Sky to say what that should be. It is a matter for the public and for government and parliament to decide what that is. But what it should do is look at what is the unique use of public funding. Should it be to replicate services that already exist, distorting competition, precluding other potential entrants from coming into the marketplace, or should it be to provide defined, unique contributions to the public?
Thank you very much. Heather, you've only just joined the governors. how shall we fund the future of broadcasting?
Well, I think the advantage of being the penultimate speaker is that you can take the best of your other panelists' contributions and try and ignore the worst, I think. Let me just try and respond at least initially to a couple of points that have been made. I mean, Mr. Kaufman's analysis of the BBC is one that relies on caricature, and we all know that life is different. Nobody says that anything that exists wholly within the public domain is bad or is wonderful, and equally so of the private sector. And that issues around Vanessa are things that clearly the BBC needs to turn its attention to. But the notion that you can privatise it, actually you could only, the BBC's value in privatising it is only if you sold it with some sort of income stream, hence the licence fee. Without that, I'm not sure the argument stands up. I mean, the B-Sky B point are interesting. You know, we should be confined, no doubt, to continuing to produce Watch With Mother, which we used to produce a number of years ago, but we shouldn't stay ahead of the times and actually seek to ensure that what we do arrive at is a public broadcast facility that does enable people to have access to programmes that enlighten, that inform, that excite, and that illuminate. And I think, in the end, the test for the BBC must be about the quality of programmes, and nobody would gainsay that. But whether it's programmes like Goodness Gracious Me, whether it's programmes such as Vanity Fair, whether it's The Human Body, The Loyalists, Time Watch, these are programmes that stand out, actually, in terms of this nation. And it seems to me that the fundamental principle that we need to hang on to before we get into the methodology of payment is Andrew's point, which is, do we believe that we should have public broadcasting available to this country into the 21st century? That is absolutely fundamental. And if we believe that increasingly the convergence of new technology means that the TV, the PC, the access to the internet, the way in which we transact our business means that it becomes our window into the world, then do we want a public broadcast facility maintained across those new technologies? And the whole notion that we constantly talk about in this country around the informed citizen means that public broadcasting, I think, is a preeminent platform for ensuring that we all continue as citizens to learn and to grow and to cope with an increasingly complex world, and a world in which we are not only citizens of this area, this region, and this state, but we are global citizens. And I think particularly that is important at a time when we are all increasingly cynical of the institutions. And therefore, our ability to make informed choices based on a range of information and access to information that is independent in terms of the ideas that are stimulating across the whole range of programs, I think remains preeminent and probably even more important. Now, if we accept that, if we accept that principle, then you go into the argument of clearly the methodology of payment. It seems to me that there is a price to be paid for democracy. I think it's a worthwhile price. And we've talked about the license fee. People have called it a poll tax. I don't think it's ever had the resonance that the poll tax had across the citizens of this country. But it seems to me that if we believe that having that access to public broadcast is important to us as citizens, then having a tax in which we can ensure that facility is continued seems to me a logical and an obvious way to continue in terms of funding it. I'm quite interested in £10 a month, whatever the BBC licence fee currently stands at. I am a Sky subscriber. I support Sky in that I have a son who's an Arsenal devotee and a partner who's a Sunderland devotee. And, you know, I buy Sky at £40-odd a month because it gives me access to sport, maybe the odd movie channel, but usually they're endless repeats. I pay £40 a month actually for sport, very little else on the offer. What I think will be important for the BBC is whether you watch 5 hours of programmes a week, 10 hours of programmes or 15, you will pay that licence because what you get in that window is important to you. And I think that is fundamental. The other issue I find interesting and surprising at times from the rest of the media market, it is almost as if the BBC is constraining the market. Actually, we have one of the most thriving media markets in this country currently, and indeed in the world. So it's hardly as if the BBC is constraining competition. That doesn't seem to me to be the case. And indeed, I think the fact that the BBC is here means we all can have a debate tonight, and we can all actually have a debate about standards and what we want from the media in a way that maybe we won't have in the future. The future is uncertain. I don't know where the IT revolution will take us. It might be in the future, it won't be Sky B sitting here, but it will be Microsoft. It might be other players in the IT market. What I do think will be important is, however the programmes are delivered, whatever the box, whatever the pipes, whatever the infrastructure, it is about that quality of programming, that quality of access to information that I think needs to be sustained. Now, you know, I don't know when we get to a fully digital world, and I think there's an interest across all of us, actually, to try and ensure that the digital world takes off, and that's why people are currently giving their hardware away free, although clearly their subscriptions are going up, as On Digital announced only the other day. Let's get the digital world operating. Let's see what happens. But if we agree that the principle of an informed citizen means we have a good public broadcasting facility, then I think some form of license fee into the future remains a prime means of paying for it.
Thank you very much, Heather. David, a dozen years ago, you seemed, I think, to suggest to the Peacock Committee that subscription was the way to go. Now I think you're saying the license fee has many years ahead of it. How should we fund the future of broadcasting?
Well, I don't think much has changed since the days of Peacock, frankly. The BBC in 1985 itself imagined that subscription would replace the license fee or supplement the license fee by the end of the century. That's what Peacock thought would happen. And it was the BBC, both to Peacock and indeed to the Allen Committee, was very open about the problems with the license fee. It acknowledged that it was the least worst way of funding public service broadcasting through the BBC, but it realized that there were many, many political problems, not least when you looked at the history of inflation. At the time that the Peacock Committee was meeting, the license fee had been increased 6 times in 10 years. And what people sometimes lose track of is the long-term process by which public sector broadcasting was funded, and people learned to appreciate what it had to offer. I mean, I've worked in the market sector for 30 years, and I think the market sector is very strong. I think it does a lot. I've worked at Sky, and I think Sky adds a great deal to what television can bring to people. But I think the BBC does something rather different by being not just public service broadcasting, because Channel 4 is public service broadcasting, advertised, funded, but by being public sector broadcasting, owned by all of us collectively. It is a guarantor of independence. It is a guarantor of quality. And it's an important proviso, as long as it delivers value for money, it would be daft of us to discard it. Now, how do we fund it? The license fee, we know, is there till at least 2006. In my view, almost certainly beyond. There is no way of displacing the license fee in the short term, and indeed all that the Gavin Davis committee is trying to do is to think up ways of supplementing the license fee. The license fee's weaknesses are all well known. There is nothing superior yet to hand. In my view, subscription will happen slowly and inevitably. And all that will happen is that the license fee reverts to what it always was. When the license fee started, it was a radio license fee, 10 shillings. It remained unchanged from 1922 to 1946. Those who paid for it, paid their license fee, got their radio services. You were a subscriber, you got a service. Indeed, when television was brought in, and there was a television supplement to the radio-only license fee, you could choose between, did you want radio, or did you want radio and television? When colour came in, you could choose between radio-only, radio and television, or colour television. Indeed, to this very day, if you don't want to pay for colour television, you can pay for black and white television. there's a very simple process available to you. But what has happened for the last 40 years is that ever since ITV was brought in, is that you pay your license fee whether you've got a television set or not, not whether you use the BBC or not. In the digital future, that will flip back again. In the digital future, once you have electronic collection of the license fee, once a majority of homes are in digital, it will be much easier to see the license fee for what it always was and what one day it will become again. A value for money judgment by consumers of a package of radio and television services which they value highly and which they voluntarily pay for. And I think that will get rid of nearly all the competition issues that arise. Let me just say one or two things about where we stand at the moment. Ray has criticized the digital supplement to the license fee that Andrew Graham mentioned. And he has quoted extensively BBC statements saying we will fund all our digital experiments out of the license fee. I personally believe the BBC was wrong to say all of that. I don't think there is in this country such a thing as a free lunch. And I think that to make all license fee payers fund digital new digital services, when we know that at least half of license fee payers will not be receiving any digital services for at least the next 10 years, seems to me wrong in principle. And that's why the digital supplement to the license fee looks to me a very fair way of solving the kind of 10-year transition in terms of how the BBC gets from its analog present to its digital future. I'm very puzzled when commercial broadcasters bitterly attack this concept of the digital supplement to the license fee on the grounds it will stop digital in its tracks. You know, Sky and On Digital in the last month have put up the cost of subscriptions by £2 per month for their services. Has that stopped digital? Of course not. If the BBC stopped supplying digital services, now that would be interesting. Maybe if the BBC took its £200 million a year that it's spending on digital and spent it all on, let's say, the Premier League. Now, that would be an interesting proposition. Maybe Sky would support that as an alternative way of dealing with this issue. So I think we're in the process of transition from the age of the detector van to the age of the computer chip. What the BBC needs is buoyancy in its revenues to fund a package of services. You can't, in the digital age, leave our national broadcaster stuck with two TV channels and never again move beyond it, and five radio channels and local radio. News 24 is, for me, another puzzle. It does have competition issues. Maybe what the BBC should have done is charge cable a subscription for News 24 while leaving it free to air on satellite and terrestrial. But I can't for the life of me see how the ITC or Sky or all the commercial stations other than Channel 5, I might say, can object to the BBC putting news onto its analog service overnight. So it's okay to have News 24 when it's only 6 hours a day, but News 24, 24 hours a day is somehow wrong. That, for me, doesn't wash. And I think it's an error of logic and an error of judgment by the rest of the commercial sector to be so bitterly opposed, first of all, to the BBC doing so much to help digital, and secondly, then getting paid for what it does. Even a £2.50 a month payment by users of digital over and above the license fee would still leave the BBC in digital deficit for probably 7 years. It would deliver £30 million next in a year's time against the £200 million that's being spent. It would take a long time for that all to work itself out. But I think that's the way forward. And I think in the long term, we will have a much more sophisticated BBC, a BBC offering a huge range of services, entirely appropriate for the digital age. And the consumer will choose what to pay for within that range of output. And that, for me, will be an excellent relationship between the BBC and the audience, and between the BBC and the non-public sector side of broadcasting. And I look forward to it. Maybe 10 or 15 years away.
Thank you very much. On a point of clarification again, do you envisage the BBC, as it were, fragmenting into channels so that there is no core left? Or will ultimately, in your view, there be a called BBC One or BBC Two, which becomes itself a digital subscription?
I think that's much harder to say, because you're trying to look 10 or 15 years ahead. You know, even looking 2 years ahead is quite difficult in the age of the internet. There's no inherent reason why BBC One and BBC Two shouldn't survive. But I fully expect to see a BBC Sports, a BBC Arts, a BBC News, a BBC Documentaries, and a lot of the services that are currently only available through UK TV, the joint venture with Flextech, I hope will one day come back to the BBC, be properly branded as BBC product, and indeed I would like to see the BBC getting into premium services. I know John Bert has said never should the BBC do it, but frankly, if Channel 4 can run a film subscription channel, why can't the BBC? Channel 5 is going to run one fairly soon. You know, the BBC is ideally placed to make it happen, and it would help the license-funded proposition much more to have a parallel service which was premium service. The same, I think, should apply to sport. Why should the BBC exclude itself from the decisions as to how sports rights are allocated? At the moment, it sits there waiting for everybody else to decide what's in the premium pay sector, and then has to bid against everybody else for what's left in the free-to-air sector. Why should it? It doesn't need to, long term. But we're now talking about a 10-year perspective, and I really believe that the BBC can make a huge difference in the future, much more than it's even made in the past, and it's made a tremendous difference to our life in the past.
Well, thank you very much indeed. We're now going to take some questions. Can I have my two brilliant people with microphones, please? If you, I recognize some distinguished people in the audience, but I won't have seen them all. And so I hope if you've got a question, you will first tell us, please, who you are and where you're coming from, as they say, if you're coming from anywhere particularly. And these microphones work rather well, but you've got to hold them rather close. So who would like to start off with a question, please? And if you want to ask someone particularly, please, yes, over here, lady. And next question after that, and one at the back there. Thank you. Please.
Sarah Nathan. I'd just like to ask Heather, who's the only person who didn't answer this question, what she feels about the digital license fee. Everybody else said what their view was, but she did not.
My view is that it is important that the BBC, I mean, in Andrew's words, has buoyancy in terms of ensuring that it can take the BBC proposition into the digital age, and therefore the digital license fee, I think, is a good way of trying to do that.
Hi, Martin Lewis, an undistinguished BBC employee, I'm afraid. My worry about what the panel said so far is there seems to be an implicit assumption that the BBC is a UK broadcaster. I think this ignores the joint venture with Discovery in the States. It ignores the joint venture with Flextech. It even ignores the publishing arm, BBC Worldwide, that sells books and videos all over the world. Now, my problem with this is I think the BBC, in a way, has burnt its bra. It's left itself without any support. And you're going to find in a few years' time...
Lots of feminists did that many years ago. They're still around, actually.
Just about. In a few years' time, you're going to have a parity of income between international commercial income and UK broadcasting income. And once that happens, how can you justify this public service subsidy to an international media player, which is what the BBC is becoming? It seems to me either has to define itself as a UK niche broadcaster or an international media company with all that digital implies and all that the internet implies, as Gerald Kaufman was saying, and in which case it can't justify public funding. I'd like to know how that international element fits into the panel's view.
Who are you addressing that question to?
Everybody, sir.
Let's start with Andrew.
I think you're absolutely right to put your finger on a major conflict within the BBC about whether it is trying to be UK or whether it's also trying to be global. I would have thought that one way that this should be resolved is that as the worldwide bit grows, the commercial bit's got to eventually be split off.
Right, okay, David?
Well, I think we just need to get this into context. 50 years ago, the Radio Times supplied 10% of the BBC's income. Today, BBC Worldwide supplies 3.5% of the BBC's income. Indeed, that's the highest it's been for 5 years. I think the notion that it's going to quadruple net revenues to the BBC in the next 5 or 6 years is pretty unlikely. If you actually look at the accounts of BBC Worldwide, you will see that in the last year for which it reported, it actually made a loss of £7 million on turnover of £400 million. and that loss was only mitigated by the sale of some shares in Flextech. This is not a honeypot, and it will take a very, very, very long time before overseas revenues begin to provide even the 10% that the BBC had 50 years ago. If it all works out fine, if Discovery America turns into the most brilliant, you know, AOL of our age and is worth $140 billion in 5 years' time, terrific. At which point, I would hope the license fee reduces or disappears, and everyone in this country benefits from that immense bonus. I don't see any prospect of that happening for a very long time. The last I looked at, there were some reports that BBC World, which is the television equivalent to the World Service, had lost another £15 million last year and wouldn't even reach break-even for another 7 years. Lots of question marks over whether that's an investment or a surefire way of losing yet more money. So this is not an issue I regard as on the horizon now, and even in 5 years' time, I don't think it'll cause us any great problems.
Thank you very much. Gerald, you want to sell it off. How would you answer this question?
The question has summed up the problem that we face with enormous accuracy, except in its assumption that the BBC is going to be enterprising enough to gain anything like the £2 billion that it scoops in from the license by commercial activity. It ought to. It ought to be able to sell abroad for large sums of revenue, not only the programming that it makes, but also access to the biggest library in the world, a library that any American conglomerate would purchase for billions. And yet the BBC keeps it buried in its cellars, apart from allowing bits to go on UK gold. The BBC, as a commercial organization, which it is, you can't be one thing and you can't be like the old story of the housemaid who had the baby and said it was only a little one. The BBC is now a commercial organization in the market. Some of its services on air funded by advertising, some of its services funded by subscription. It's all that, and yet it pretends to be purely a public funded public service organization. And that's why arguments that I've heard in which have helped to provoke the question, arguments I've heard are utterly baseless. They're not living in the real world. We're told that if the BBC isn't allowed to have this license increase and all the money it demands from the government, then we're going to be faced with monopolies. What world are we living in? If I want the news now, as I did with the Israeli elections last Monday night, I don't tune into useless Newsnight with its chatter. I don't tune into BBC News 24 with its talking heads. I go straight onto the internet and I get the results, and I get the results as they're being declared. If I want the news in the morning, I don't turn on the parochial Little Today program. I log into the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post every morning without fail. What we've heard from this platform by people who are protectionists of the BBC for various reasons of their own does not begin to confront the real world. And when David, who is one of the most convincing exponents of a case I've ever heard, generally, when I hear from David that there's no such thing as a free lunch, the problem is that what the BBC is trying to do is dictate to us a table d'hote, whereas in fact we're now in an a la carte world.
Can I ask Gerald a question within this? If you were going to privatise the BBC, would you be selling the right to collect the licence fee, or would you abolish the licence fee at that point?
I'd abolish the licence.
How much do you think you'd get for the BBC at that point?
That would be for a better chancellor than Nigel Lawson to find out when he floated it on the market.
Right. Shall we go on to our next question? Thank you very much.
Linda Leonard, National Consumer Council. Really, surely what we should be debating is not the BBC per se, but in this era of transition, what we require as a society from public service broadcasting. As one or two other people mentioned, the BBC is, of course, the public sector broadcaster, but it's not the only public service broadcaster. What we need to do is to stand back and think about what we want from public service broadcasting, how it then should be defined and delivered and funded, and within that, whether or not the BBC should continue. And if it does continue, what is its distinctiveness, and how should its obligations be put more clearly than they are currently, in order that we can see whether or not it is actually delivering those obligations. Secondly, can I just mention something else, which is, as grateful as I am for this debate and seminar and for the interesting contributions, it's very instructive coming relatively new to this area at the National Consumer Council, how little room is given to the public view of public service broadcasting, and here we have an eminent panel on which the public or consumer view is actually not represented. And I find that is more frequently than not the case in debates about the future of broadcasting.
Well, thank you very much for putting your point. Heather, the argument is that the BBC fails to define what it should be funded for, that whatever it does is public service broadcasting. We've heard some suggestions here as to what it should be doing. What should it be doing? And therefore, perhaps we'll begin to work out how it should be funded.
Well, I thought what I was trying to convey was the BBC's distinctiveness and quality across just trying to give some exemplars of some of those programmes. And it seems to me that it is one of the roles of the governors, but indeed the role of the BBC, to make sure that it constantly states that purpose and that criteria, and I think you're absolutely right, ensures that it is judged against that criteria and is accountable for that criteria. And I think broadening the accountability of the BBC and in terms of involving the public more in the public broadcasting debate, I think is one of the fundamental objectives over the next few years, and certainly will be important in the lead up to charter renewal. So I mean, the BBC will stand and fall against that quality and distinctiveness of its output, of those quality of programmes, which are about informing people, are about enlightening, are about exciting, are about that whole idea of how do we, the informed citizen, how do we ensure that is exactly what we all have access to. I mean, that's interesting in Gerald's point, which is that, you know, he can get a whole range of services, just as he's articulated. The BBC is not stopping him doing that. The BBC is offering another facility to people who might want to watch the chatter at Newsnight or listen to Today or listen to Goodness Gracious Me or whatever it might be. Nobody is stopping access on the internet to the latest election results. And it seems to me that what we want is choice, and we want to ensure that public service broadcasting is maintained in an area, in an arena of choice, where we do not know how the technology will fall out at the moment.
Very good. Gerald, you wanted to make a contribution. The point really is that the consumer is not being consulted about it.
The consumer is never consulted in the case of the BBC. All the consumer is done is told to pay a poll tax every year, and the government hasn't got any say, rightly, in what the BBC broadcasts. The Board of Governors, I don't know what they do and what their role is, but they're certainly not a board of directors who hold the Director General to account. But it's interesting when you say that I really do believe that the BBC believes that whatever it does is public service broadcasting, in the way that Peter Mandelson's grandfather, Herbert Morrison, asked what socialism was, said whatever a Labour government does is socialism.
We know that's true now, don't we?
Well, as a lickspittle of the government, what else could I possibly say? But we've just heard that the role of the BBC is to be informing and enlightening. The Vanessa Show, informative and enlightening. The Big Ticket Show, organised to help sell Camelot scratch cards, informative and enlightening. There is a very serious and important role for the kind of public service broadcasting ethos that the BBC created, and which it will never be forgotten for, must always be thanked for, but which more and more it forgets as its role, if it ever knew how to do it anymore.
Andrew Graham.
Just a very quick one. The question that was raised about the role of the consumer in this is, I mean, it can't just be sort of assumed that we need to find the representative consumer and put him or her on a panel.
But we have a poll tax.
No, hold on. There is a fundamentally difficult conceptual problem here which society needs to think about. I mean, it's all very well saying, where's the consumer? Well, society is organized around two fundamentally different principles. This happens in broadcasting, education, the health service, all sorts of places. In the marketplace, every person's pound is as good as everybody else's pound. Broadly speaking, the person's over there shaking their head, broadly speaking, massive differences of income and wealth, when you go and spend your pound, it counts the same as everybody else's. In the political dimension, or the public dimension, everybody's vote is as good as everybody else's. Lots of problems about that, but in principle. But trying to work out how you organize that political participation, so you find out what people want in the political public sphere, is very, very difficult. We don't have a political marketplace. Voting for the House of Commons isn't it. We have all sorts of ways of trying to make public bodies accountable in one way or another. And in my view, the great danger at the moment is because we've somewhat lost trust in a lot of our public bodies, we're trying to micromanage them. And that is absolutely killing off the core qualities that you want in your public sector institutions, which is people having public sector values, being committed to principles like empowering people, giving people impartial information, educating them as opposed to giving them propaganda. You don't get people doing this if you micromanage them.
So in the last resort, we've got to give them the money.
No, in the last resort, there's a very difficult problem. I just don't want it to be the case. I think all we've got to do is put the representative consumer on the panel and we've solved the problem.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, over here, please, and then in the front.
Peter Robertson, I'd like to put 2 points to Gerald Kaufman on the notion of ultimately privatising the BBC. First, I wonder if I could tempt you to go a little further on the question first put by Helen and restated by David as to what exactly would be the revenue stream that was being privatised, because clearly you would have to have in mind some completely different form of income for the BBC. But secondly, I note and was very pleased to note at the time that your committee thought it wrong to privatise Channel 4, not least on the grounds that the shareholder influence would A, take money out and away from programmes and public service, but B, would also tend to narrow the range of the programmes provided and make them more like the rest of the market. Why do those arguments not apply to the BBC?
On the question of what you'd be selling if you sold the BBC on the open market, I would advocate that you sold the television services and the full structure. I would not privatise radio. I would set up a public radio corporation for radio. And when I'm asked by people who operate in the market, and I admire them for operating in the market, what the market will pay, I haven't the faintest idea. But I would sell the BBC as a going concern on the market in the way that the gas boards were sold and in the way that the electricity boards were sold. And you could, if you liked, build in a golden share to deal with the public service ethos. These will be matters for discussion. It's income. Well, I'll tell you what I have been advocating for years, though whether it would now work, I don't know. I have advocated for years that the BBC go into partnership, though the BBC has lost that particular ball, with BT, because BT is the ideal partnership for any national broadcaster. On the one hand, it has access to practically every home in the country through its telephone lines, and that's the way we're going to go into people's homes in the future. In audiovisual communications. And secondly, it has so much money, it doesn't know what to do with it. It's the only organisation in this country that funds its entire investment programme from current revenue. It's a very, very rich organisation. So it will provide the access that a public sector, public broadcasting organisation needs, at the same time having the funds with which to finance it. It's the ideal marriage. With regard to Channel 4, the whole point about Channel 4 is that unlike the BBC, which has a charter and agreement which it interprets in whatever way its board of governors sees fit, Channel 4 has a strict statutory remit And the reason that Channel 4 is, in my view, the best of the television channels in this terrestrial television channels in this country, if you ask me my favourite television channels, I would say Sky Cinema and TNT, because they provide me with the terrible old films which I love. But if you're looking, if you're, I believe that Channel 4 is easily the best terrestrial channel, and the reason for that is it's got a statutory remit which Jeremy Isaacs and Michael Grade and Michael Jackson have built upon, and that is why I am opposed to changing the structure of Channel 4, because it works. My own view is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Channel 4 ain't broke, so I don't want it fixed. By God, the BBC's badly broke.
Thank you very much.
In the front here.
Roger Silverstone. I'd like to bring back the panel's attention to the question of the audience. Now, there is one way that we can actually deal with the audience, it seems to me, in these discussions, but that's through looking at audience share. And it's quite clear that, both the major all the major broadcasters, BBC in particular, are losing audience share currently. At the moment, it stands at about 40% joint with BBC One, BBC Two, and very recently, BBC One share fell below 30%. And in households with cable and satellite, that share of a whole BBC service falls to 30%. Now, it seems to me that the argument about subscription implies that people will buy in. But the argument about subscription also implies that people will buy out, or at least they should be given the opportunity to do that. What are the political and economic implications, and I address this both to Ray and to David in particular, of, as it were, a declining audience share in an increasingly multimedia market?
Ray, why don't you start? Am I right in thinking that non-mainstream television channel audience is now about 10%?
It's actually hit a high of 15% at some times recently.
All right.
But I think what that shows still is that after 10 years of multi-channel television operating, the vast majority, 85% or at times up to 90% of viewing, are to the main terrestrial channels. And even in markets where it's more developed, certainly the U.S. market, where there are scores and hundreds of channels for 20 years or more, the majority of viewing is still to the principal networks that have the universal reach. That privilege of being automatically in every home at the flick of a switch is only going to apply to BBC, ITV, Channel 4, and to a little bit smaller extent, Channel 5, for many, many years to come, 10, 15. That itself creates a critical mass, which is going to allow most of those channels to have their financing, certainly by advertising on channels 3, 4, and 5. And the BBC, if the licensee, if there is a public commitment and a political commitment to maintain the universal core services for their public purpose, there's no reason that should affect the existence of those institutions.
Thank you very much, Deed. And
I'd like to, Michael Hollingworth, Media Society. I'd like to start off with a question which is quite fundamental, and that is that there are only two kinds of programmes. There are programmes which you make for an advertiser, which I did with Yorkshire Television and Granada Television, and there are programmes that you make for the viewer and listener with no other concern but that. That should be the two types of broadcasting in this country. I am deeply dismayed to hear that once again McKinsey have got its claws into the BBC. I've just driven up the Strand and past Shelmeck's house where I used to work. They were the first people in Britain to McKinsey-ide. It's now up for sale. They are experts.
Give us your question.
They are experts at borrowing your watch and telling you the time. My question is this. Why is it that nobody has ever thought of the gratification purpose of this document?
Sorry, I do apologize, madam.
The TV license is a piece of rather cheap toilet paper with a stamp on it, covered in extremely tiny print. Gerald Crawford and I are both wearing quite expensive watches from the same manufacturer. We got gratification purchase. My question is, the only benefit that this conveys to the public, and they are deeply resentful of that, is it stops somebody from coming into your house. It also prevents you from being arraigned in front of a court. for nearly £100. That is a lousy gratification purchase, and in 70 years nobody's thought of a better scheme of giving the public something for that £100 better than this piece of toilet paper.
Thank you very much indeed. At the back there.
Yes, I'm Peter Lewis, LSE Radio Research Project. Is this working? Yes, radio. Not much mentioned. Yesterday I was listening to KPFA Berkeley, California, and subscribed a few dollars to this station now celebrating 50 years of being listener, supported by listener subscription. Today I was glad to be listening to my tranny to Radio 4 Longwave, and I noticed two Sundays ago Arsenal supporters at Highbury were listening to Radio 5 Live. Indeed. To keep up with the picture. In other words, I listen to radio, but I've listened also to radio stations that have been subscribed to by listeners. Radio, of course, has not had its separate license fee for 25 years or more. Do the panel have any misgivings about the future of radio in the light of the argument they've been suggesting? And in particular, would they suggest that some of BBC stations, for instance, GLR, which gets a very tiny percentage, might possibly be offered for public subscription, supported in that kind of way? Because my final point, let's be quite clear, commercial radio is not public service radio, as the criticism about its coverage of the Kosovo or lack of coverage recently made shows. Only the only public service radio we have in the country is BBC. How would that be?
The concern is what happens to radio should the license fee be damaged or removed. Gerald.
I'd say two things about radio. As I've already said, I believe that radio is too important, public service radio is too important to be left to the BBC as it's a present run. And that is why I would set up a public service state radio corporation funded by the taxpayers but at arm's length from the government so that the government can't interfere with its content. But the second thing to be said is that we are still looking too narrowly at the way in which we can receive radio. When the Select Committee, which I chair, went to the west coast of the United States just over a year ago to look into audiovisual communications, we went into Silicon Valley and spent a couple of hours with a small company run by two young Englishmen who had come to the west coast of the United States first of all in order to realize their talents, which are so constrained in the environment here, and secondly, to become millionaires, both, and they had done both quite speedily. When we had finished our evidence session with them, one of these young men said, well, now I'm going to go to my computer and listen to the Spurs match on my computer. Because you can, of course, now listen to the radio on the internet. And you can have a choice of world radio as well as being able to listen to the best of the BBC. Digital radio is simply a staging post. And one of my, I won't say quarrels, one of my misgivings about this whole concentration on digital in this country is that everybody in the United States West Coast whom we spoke to last year said it's a side alley. It may very well be said that that the converged box is not here yet. It's going to be here very, very, very soon indeed, and it will leapfrog everything that we're doing. That is the way in which we can get radio and radio of high quality.
David, I think radio does create more public issues than television. In the long term, one can easily see how all of BBC's television services, far more than currently offered, could be funded quite simply on a subscriber basis. At this stage, doing that to radio looks a very, very distant prospect. So I think it's quite important for the BBC now, rather than then, to make the case for public service radio and make the case for it to be funded out of the license fee. It's all... BBC, for my money, is a little too coy about this, as if it's embarrassed by the amount of money that's being spent. It's roughly 25%, 24% of the license fee that's being spent. I think if the money is being spent and is being well spent, the BBC should be very positive about it and go out and make the case for Radio 3, for Radio 4, neither of which could conceivably be funded at their current levels out of any commercial revenues or out of the commercial sectors. Even Radios 1, 2 and 5, which could conceivably be funded out of the commercial sector, they've got to demonstrate their distinctiveness, and they've got to, the BBC's got to make the case for that. But for a very long time, you know, since 1971, when the radio license fee was abolished, funnily enough, 15 years later, the BBC regretted it. But for a very long time, the television license has carried radio, and radio has become a poor relation. Radio is far too important and far too rich a medium to be a poor relation. There's a lot that the BBC does in radio, which is well ahead of what it does in TV, but you don't often hear about that.
Thank you very much.
Can I just
yes,
put it and make it quick? I'm just rather puzzled by some of Gerald's arguments. he seems to be saying that in terms of digital technology, that's where it's all at, and in the long run, I'm sure that's right. And yet he seems to be criticising for the BBC for wanting to go in for that, so I'm puzzled at that level. The second thing is, of course it's true that all of these things can be done over your telephone or will soon be able to be done over your telephone, but I still think that people change, although the internet has been probably the most rapidly growing thing in consumer world we've ever seen, it's still the case that people's habits change more slowly than I think sometimes is allowed for, sort of by techno-futurist or whatever you want to call them. I mean, it is the case that you are doing quite different activities when you're looking at your computer. The screen's about this big, and you're about 18 inches away from it, and your body's like this. There's another part of the day when the screen's about this big, and you're about 3 feet away, and your body's like this. And in the one case, you want to interact. In the other case, you just want to sit there and listen and be entertained. And I'm not sure those two things are going to merge that fast.
Thank you very much. A question here.
Yes, thank you. My name is Oscar Rodriguez Aguilar. I'm a Latin American with British citizenship. I came in through the back door. Anyway, I am a postgraduate a student at the LSE in economics. I did my postgraduate studies here. And then I was kidnapped across the road by the BBC World Service as the economics program commentator, I suppose, to put it mildly. I was there for several years until just a few months ago, 6 months ago. And before I go on to the question, I want to thank the gentleman, the last speaker there, who brought radio back to the forum, because I do remember a documentary on BBC television commemorating television in this country, and there was a presenter who asked a young boy, an English boy, what he preferred, radio or television. And the boy was very quick to say he preferred radio. So astonished, the television presenter asked him why. And the boy said, because radio draws better pictures than television. And I thought that was brilliant. And I'm very convinced of that fact. And that's why I want to ask the panel what they think of a very particular, and I think that the BBC World Service is a very different kettle of fish. Thank you. I heard...
could you put your question?
Yes, I heard two words, enlightenment and pretense. I think you mentioned fragmentation and you mentioned pretense. And the World Service, I believe, has been fragmented to death in many aspects. Also that there has been a pretense of it not being privatized. And the reason why I bring this up is because in the Latin American section, I personally, on many occasions, many years ago, suggested that we somehow try and bring the private sector into funding at least my economic program, but it was always rejected. And funnily enough, today, the Latin American section actually does go and sell services to many Latin American radios. I must say this. And the actual payment that the radio stations in Latin America pay the Latin American section of the World Service is not direct. They actually pay the radio broadcasters, the other radio stations, and then, say, Radio Centro in Mexico will pay the Latin American section of the BBC. So, in a way, I think it is true what Mr. Coffin has said. And that's why my question is, do you really think that the World Service has been done any good service by the whole process of fragmentation and really doomed to its real existence that it used to be before?
Do you want it funded in a different way?
Yes. And I want a completely different different entity within the BBC itself. I think it's been killed, and I'd like to know what your views are.
Thank you. Well, the BBC, the World Service is funded at the moment, is it not, by the licence fee? That's the point about it.
I mean, the World Service is funded directly by Foreign and Commonwealth Office direct grant in aid, and therefore it has a totally different funding structure, and in fact has a totally different accountability structure, and it cannot supplement its position by the use of private income in terms of some of those grant conditions. That's not to say that we shouldn't find ways of celebrating the World Service more in the future, and I think the World Service, it provides an incredibly important window into the world for many millions of people, but it's a very different proposition in terms of, and distinct from how the rest of the BBC is funded.
That said, though, it's just worth pointing out that when I started at the BBC 35 years ago, I was working at the World Service, and my voice, like yours, was received over the all the way around the world, trying to predict the outcome of the 1964 Olympic Games. But I noticed recently that one of the jewels in the BBC World Service crown, the monitoring unit at Caversham, had turned itself into a subscription service, a profitable one, making £2 or 3 million a year. In other words, even within the very peculiar funding structure of the World Service, which is FCO funding a public service broadcaster, buying in with a lot of production now for the World Service coming from the public service broadcaster, so their revenue streams are getting more and more intermingled. It is possible to have more inventive ways of supplementing that funding, and I think in the digital future especially, we should be much more open-minded. I don't think that this is, you know, an Ark of the Covenant that we have to bow down and worship. Let's look at the outcome that we want. Let's see how to get there.
Andrew Graham, briefly, and then I think we've got time for just two more questions.
What's happened to the World Service is the argument against having parts of public service broadcasting directly funded on an annual basis direct from the Treasury, and that's why I'm against the proposal that Gerard Kaufman put up.
Thank you very much. The voice of ITV in the back there, I see.
Well, it's actually the voice of Simon Albury. I work for ITV, but I do have some views of my own, questions of my own.
What is your question?
So if I, well, what I'd like to do is to put a question to Heather Rabatz and then slag off Andrew Graham, if that's acceptable.
So she gets to reply.
Maybe even you'll get a reply. And of course, slag off is just to add a bit of audience interest. The question is a very simple one, which is, should BBC One seek to compare to match audience share with ITV? The reason I ask that has a lot to do with the things that Andrew Graham's said and Andrew Graham has written. I've read at least three pieces by Andrew Graham on broadcasting, and they're extremely persuasive as long as you've never watched BBC One. He talks, and he has today, about the need to be independent from the market. But the trouble is, over the past few years, BBC One has sought to compete for audience share. So in fact, it has had to more and more mirror what the market provides. It has had a millstone placed round its neck by politicians. The BBC, and Gerald Kaufman says, you know, public service broadcast, it sees it as whatever it thinks it should be. And there's no sense of priorities in the BBC. Andrew Graham has also argued that there's valuable common knowledge that we need from the BBC and we need to be informed. The other day I sent some evidence personally to somebody who was on the Davis Committee, and the evidence was the evidence that my company's submitting, but I sent it with a note. It just happened on that day that I wrote, tonight's panorama, as you will see, is about, are designer clothes a rip-off? Now it seems to me that there may be a place for that somewhere in the broadcasting
show. Could you just sum up your...
Yes, my point is this.
That
the research the BBC has done recently shows that BBC One shows less hours of the public service categories of arts and music, documentaries and feature, drama, films, regional news and factual programs. It is actually seeking to match the ITV for share. If it seeks to continue to seek to match it for share, then it will be driven by the values of ITV. So I come to my question, should BBC One seek to match ITV for audience share?
Very briefly, please, Andrew.
I
was going first, so he gets slagged off second, but sure. I don't mind.
Agree very substantially about the point about the BBC should not try and match identical. It was no point. No. Agree completely. Secondly, it doesn't follow that somehow there are a set of nicely identifiable programs, and you can label these things as public service broadcasting, and these are over here, and ITV can all be left to get on with their bit over here. And the reason is twofold. First of all, the values that you want to be embodied in some institution like the BBC or Channel 4, public service values, they are not genre specific. They are across all genres. You want your soaps to be things which don't present stereotypes of people. You want them to be made by people who care about those sort of things. Now, in the past, in the UK, ITV has also been very good about this because it's been competing with the BBC. What we've had is a high-level equilibrium in which the BBC has been doing the sort of things we want to see happen in the public with sorts of values about impartiality and authenticity respected, and ITV has been pulled up. As the commercial world gets hot up, ITV's commitment to those public service obligations will drop. So the case for the BBC again goes up. Let me give you a very specific example. It hasn't happened in this country, but it could happen in this country. You can find US producers of commercial shows who admit that racial remarks sell television. That's not what I want to see on my television. It's not what ought to happen on public service television.
Thank you, Andrew. Heather.
I would echo that. I don't think it is about competing with ITV and showing who wants to be a millionaire five times a night. That's absolutely right. Yes. No, I don't think we should be into that numbers game. The difficulty with the BBC is if we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, of course, because everybody argues if it goes below a certain percentage, then that undermines the license. And there's a horn of a dilemma. What is important is that I think the point that Andrew's just been making, it's about what is the quality of the output that BBC One puts on. And that's partly about reach, it's about a social inclusion agenda, it is about the impartiality and authenticity, and it is about portraying people in their lives in ways that maybe the commercial channels will have less interest in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Could I just take one last question? Disagreement with Heather. I actually think the BBC has to care about share, BBC One and BBC Two.
Yeah, I wasn't saying we didn't care.
It's important. It's been important ever since Hugh Green laid it down in 1960. This is not something new. It's 39 years old. Mm. And the reason is that the BBC's got to cover the whole territory. It can't turn its back on the audience. It can't retreat into a ghetto. As long as it's funded the way it is, which is through the licence fee, it's got to serve all audiences, all people, because nearly everyone pays the licence fee. It can't just say we're going to pick and choose which audiences we're going to serve.
That wasn't the point that I was making. It's not about copying or replicating what goes out on ITV. It is about ensuring that you have something on offer that relates to everybody, and that is different.
Okay, thank you. Question here at the back.
My name is Catherine Hastings. I'm from the BBC. I wanted to return to the issue that was raised by the National Consumer Council about this perception that licensee payers are somehow disengaged from the debate about public service broadcasting, because the BBC does numerous actions to try to engage viewers and listeners in debate. We have standing councils such as the Broadcast Council through the regions and nations. We hold events all around the country that are advertised locally. There are telephone lines. Every new stage of services is subject to public consultation. We publish customer files. I mean, that could go on for a long time. I wondered whether the panel could maybe suggest where this feeling of disengagement therefore arises from, and what would help licensee payers feel that they do have a contribution to make to the whole debate, and that the BBC does genuinely feel accountable to that.
It's not going to happen until there's choice. Frankly, until you've got a choice as to whether you pay for the BBC or you don't, you're always going to have that element of resentment that you have no control over the level of license fee and you've got no control over whether you pay it or not. Because if you want to watch ITV, you've still got to pay the license fee. If you want to watch Sky, you've still got to pay the license fee. So I admire all these consultations that the BBC does, but it's just not going to be a satisfying substitute. In the long run, it will all change and we'll go back to where we were in 1954 and it won't be so much of a problem. But in the meantime, all you're offering is a surrogate for real audience involvement, real accountability from the broadcaster to the audience. At the moment, it's all indirect, it's all dissipated, and it's all, frankly, a touch unsatisfactory.
Right, and we've come to the end. Now, last word, Ray, you want to say something?
I was just going to say, following up, David, that you don't have to wait for the long run to do that kind of test, because the technology didn't exist before to do what you can do today in digital homes. You're able to have an authorization of each and every service or package of services that the viewer wants. And I know David said earlier that he thought there was an error of logic and judgment for the commercial broadcasters to oppose the digital fee, but I think actually it is entirely logical and the correct judgment to let viewers make that choice. David, if you said it's unfair to make people who don't have digital television pay for the new services, it can't be any fairer to let digital homes who don't want those services pay when you have a mechanism you can use today to give them the choice.
In the long run, I would accept that. In the short run, it's not deliverable. And in the medium term, commercial services like Sky should embrace what the BBC is doing and not be so resentful and so, short-sighted in terms of the value that the BBC's digital investment is bringing to their business. I guarantee you it makes a huge amount of difference to Sky.
And there, I think we really must stop. My president is giving me warning signs here. I think the answer may be for Gavin Davies after the Goldman Sachs flotation to pay for the whole thing himself. But he hasn't offered yet. May I thank you all very much indeed for listening to us tonight. Thank you.
Just before you depart, I'd like to thank, on behalf of Media LSE, Richard Lindsay and the panel for joining us this evening and giving us the benefit of their thoughts and their views. It's reinforced my own perception of things that the BBC seems to be entering now its most difficult period since 1923. And that's saying something. Just before you all disappear, and I'm very glad to see so many of you here, just to say that the Media at LSE is a new venture at the school, and we are developing a major teaching and research program here. And one part of that is going to be a series of public debates and lectures. I hope further ones with the Media Society. But in any event, I would hope to see you very much again here soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Roger.